This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So today what we're going to do, we're going to talk about two of the very small pieces of environmental medicine. It's quite vast, and we're going to cover some of the things that are, they come up quite a bit. I'm sure to clinicians, parents come up with these questions. And there isn't as much information out there regarding these, so we'll cover those. The format will be a little bit different. These will be case-based. Environmental medicine can get quite chemical and dry. And these are a little bit older cases, so you're going to find yourself being a physician, more like a Doctor Who kind of traveling through time and figuring out what's going on. We're going to talk about different types of various heavy metals and exposure in children, the clinical effects of these things, how to prevent and treat them. And then we're going to talk about source of radiation in children, both iatrogenic and accidental or possible non-accidental. And then long-term effects of radiation exposure in children, which we should be quite concerned about, especially that we treat children who need a lot of procedures and radiation exposure. The competencies that we're going to cover is mostly patient care and medical knowledge in this regard. So starting with our first case, we go back to 1528. These are real cases. You are Dr. Priscilius, the founder of toxicology in general. You called in to solve the medical mystery of a number of governors in south of Germany who were suffering from tingling in the arms and legs, dizziness, loss of cognition, and a few cases of death. Since all these people work in the same place, you decide that to visit their workplace, and you find that this is a beautifully light-filled city hall, which has two marvelous paintings hanging on the wall. And these two marvelous paintings are the four apostles. Any thoughts as to what this has to do with any of this? So this is a real case. These, the white robe that you see there, it's made using lead oxide. And we're not going to talk about lead because there's been much talked about lead, and I'm not going to bore you with that. But the red and the green, they each have their own characteristics, and there's a lot of mercury used in there. And after answering the questions, if there's a little bit of time, we'll go into actual historical background of these things, but for about 1 or 2 minutes. But we're going to talk a little bit about mercury poison because the population does get exposed to mercury almost invariably. Mercury, like most heavy metals, happens in nature, and it comes in three different forms. And whenever you take a history or you want to consider reading about any kind of heavy metal, you need to understand that there are three forms of these things. These are elemental, organic, or inorganic. And each one of these things have very different toxicities and bioavailability. In terms of mercury, elemental mercury tends to be silvery white liquid. Some of you might have played with it as a child. And unless you inhale them, they're not so much of a problem. Methyl mercury and ethyl mercury are the two things that the public's most concerned about, and we do get some exposure to. And inorganic mercury is mostly industrial applications that children rarely come across, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So epidemiology, most of the things we know about mercury, it's important to understand, it comes from two cases. That's it. One was Minamata Bay, where a factory actually dumped a lot of mercury into the bay. The fish ate them, and people were using the fish. It wasn't so much the fish that was the problem, it's the oil from the fish that people used for cooking. And the experience we have is mostly in pregnant women and children who came, who were from Minamata Bay. The other one was in Iraq in 1970s. For whatever reason, fungicide-treated grain accidentally got into the food supply. It was supposed to be for other applications, and people got exposed to it. And there's quite a bit of evidence as to what happens to these children when they get exposed. The sporadic cases are the ones that we see more in this country and Western Hemisphere is contaminated fish, breast milk of exposed mothers. And this is more important in Scandinavian countries where they do use a whale blubber and they eat quite a bit of fish and they get exposure. Vapor inhalation and transdermal contamination usually comes from contaminated cloth diapers. These are typically washed with mercury compounds as a fungicide. How much is this used is not so clear. Some are abandoning, some are still using them. But there is some transdermal contamination through these, and that is not a regulated industry as far as we know. Skin bleaches continue to be a problem. We'll talk a little bit more about it. So elemental mercury, this is the one that we don't really come in contact as much, but broken fluorescent light bulbs are a problem. If you notice, all the manometers now are removed from the exam rooms. That was another big source of them. Thermometers are no longer allowed to have mercury in them. Even if they look like they have mercury, they do make a mercury look-alike resin compound. I don't know why would anybody do that, because it's so hard to read those. But they would do that. Batteries used to have mercury in them. They've now been removed for the past 7 to 8 years. So anyone who ingests a battery, the chance of having mercury in there is quite low. Those of you who do international medicine, you need to be aware of this, because in many parts of the world, including Central America and South America, small farmers, they supplement their income by using mercury to separate gold. And they dump the mercury after a few uses into the soil, which makes it into the water, and they get exposed to these things. The vegetation can actually pick up mercury out of the soil along with its contaminants like cyanide, and that becomes a source of contamination. Peru is one of the examples of where farmers are having toxicity. And then folk remedies, Santeria tends to continue to have mercury compounds in it, and it's mostly elemental mercury. The inorganic mercury is mostly Ayurvedic medicine, and as Ayurvedic medicine is becoming more and more formalized, they're taking any of these toxins out of them. So it depends on where you get it, but there are a number of people who still make them, and you can find them on both sides of the Atlantic. Folk skin lightening creams, a lot of these things are not FDA controlled. In the U.S., we don't have them, but in Asia, a lot of these creams that work extremely well and they lighten the skin, they tend to have inorganic mercury in them. They're typically not extremely well absorbed, but in time they do cause skin changes. And mercury cyanide are compounds that are extremely rare in children. They're usually exposure to parents who've been exposed. So you get secondhand exposure for inorganic mercury. This is where really you get a lot of your questions, organic mercury. If there's anything to consider is this. And people talk about, you know, what kind of fish should I buy from Whole Foods or there to make sure it doesn't have mercury in it? The answer is it doesn't matter where you go fishing. You can go on top of the mountain and fish, and you can go to the bottom of the ocean, you will have fish that has mercury in it. And that's because you cannot keep mercury in one place. The way it gets into the air is typically in anthropogenic causes. We burn coal. Coal has two things in it. It has a lot of impurities, but the big ones are mercury and arsenic. And even when they try to wash them, which is done nowadays, you get some of the mercury into the air. Arsenic is not so much of a problem, as you'll see, but mercury is. It gets washed down, and to this point, it's still harmless to human beings. But what happens after that is that the algae picks it up as part of the food. It makes it organic. It makes it methyl mercury. And then at that point, it gets into the food chain. And that's why, even if you can't remember which fish I should eat, The longer a fish lives, the higher on the food chain, and the more they eat before you catch them, the higher the amount of mercury in their body. That gets into the fish, it can get into humans, and then it can get into the breast milk. And it's very interesting how very effectively mercury is excreted through the breast milk. You got to be careful, because then the question that comes up afterwards, well, should I formula feed? And we're trying to promote breastfeeding for a number of reasons, and the fear of mercury is certainly not the reason to do that. So the question is, does it really make a difference or not? Because a lot of populations are exposed to mercury, especially those who eat a lot of fish. And we do know in high exposure, and again, this is from past experiences, that it does cause mental retardation. And the four things I mentioned, it has to do with the amount of exposure. So there's extremely high exposure and there's a high exposure. But prenatally, it does cause mental retardation. It does cause a lot of neurologic problems like cerebral palsy, ataxia reflex anomalies that come later on, and then failure to thrive actually happens in those who are not exposed to extremely high levels, but they're exposed a little bit chronically, and they have a delayed reaction. Lower dosage For example, the two big populations that get exposed to mercury right now are people of Faroes Island, which is an island off of Denmark, it's a Danish territory, and then Samoans. And Samoans eat a lot of fish, and they happen to be in an area where there's a lot of wind coming off of Asia, which has a lot of mercury with it, gets dumped into the ocean, and that's how they get exposed to it. People of Faroes Island, they cook with whale blubber. So if there's one thing to do, cut down on your whale blubber cooking, you should be fine. But there's no clear evidence as to whether it really causes anything or not. It depends on which studies you read, how do they measure things, and how much of a detail they look into. But the largest studies show that there is some effect, and there is a subtle effect. And these effects are statistically significant and borderline clinically significant. Okay, so that's a little bit controversial as to whether eating practices in these places should change. And certainly in the Western population, we don't see that. We don't get enough fish, and we don't get exposed enough to see any of those things. The chronic exposure are some of the things you'll see, and these are mostly industrial exposures, not so much in children. And you do see, again, in the order of increasing amount and chronicity, you see these things. You see paresthesia and ataxia. Children go on to become weakness, and weakness mostly neurologic rather than muscular. Ptosis and visual impairment, and then hearing impairment, aphasia. And you go all the way down to super and coma, which has to do with sporadic high exposures in the midst of chronic exposure. Again, these are mostly industrial. They're from adult studies. What's interesting is that susceptibility to mercury seems to be quite variable. As we're finding out with lead, that there's no safe amount, there seems to also apply to mercury as well. As low as 9.6 microgram per liter of blood, which those who love fishing can get, is something you can see. And there are two ways of measuring it. It's the amount in the blood and the amount in the urine. We're going to see which one's the better way to measure these things. In terms of chronic exposure, clinical signs and symptoms, you can see dermatosis or acridemia, which is really the best publicized form of mercury poisoning. And it's called Pink's disease. You see a lot of pictures. And a lot of patients come in thinking they have Pink's disease because it mimics a lot of other diseases. Some of those diseases themselves are quite rare. Some of those are much more common. But you can see those. So you would see them with both organic and inorganic poisoning, but exanthemas, edema, desquamation on hands and feet, neurologic symptoms, and high blood pressure. High blood pressure can happen at very low dosages of mercury exposure. But as you can see in the feet, there are a number of things that look like that. Erythromelalgia, which is a sodium channel problem, can present this way. It's a rare disease, but it can certainly present this way. And some of the practices that these patients have, putting their feet in the bucket of ice, which patients with pain problems sometimes do, actually physically causes desquamation of the feet. So you want to be a little bit careful calling these things. Of all the forms of acridemia, the hands are probably the most pathognomonic. Hardly anything gives you that very clear cutoff line in your hands with erythema, except for maybe child abuse. But they typically tend to be bilateral. And the rash you get on the body is very nonspecific. And the diagnosis of these things based on a rash is almost impossible. But the other two findings along with the history is useful. Clinical signs and symptoms, again, so neurodevelopmental things, and they eventually go to the kidneys. All heavy metals love the kidney. A lot of times they are excreted through the kidney as soon as they get into the system. They can be teratogenic. That's mostly inorganic and methyl mercury. You have to get a lot of it. And they can cause decreased cardiac variability. And that's very interesting because you don't see frank cardiomyopathy as you see with some of the other heavy metals like cadmium, but they do cause decreased variability. So they affect it in a subtle way, and you can get hypertension. Methylmercury has been associated with leukemia in adults. That doesn't mean only adults get them. It simply means it takes a long while for it to really kick in and cause bone marrow problems. Acute exposure, again, how do you get these things? Typically, fluorescent light bulbs. Honestly, if a fluorescent light bulb breaks, open up the windows, they typically have a gas, they don't have liquid in them. And if you have anything with liquid, do not vacuum them. That's the worst thing you can do. They present with cough and dyspnea. And my kids did this. My kids broke a light bulb. And everybody panics. We just had them removed from the room. And if they don't have cough and dyspnea, the chance of them having anything else afterwards is quite rare. So we can counsel these parents on the phone when this thing happens and tell them, open the windows, don't go around, don't vacuum the stuff, simply clean them up. And the amount you get in most light bulbs, especially the compact ones, isn't enough to cause any problems. After 2 to 3 hours of ventilation, you can go back in, and you don't need to call the fire department for these things. But if you have longer-lasting effects from chronic exposure to the fumes, you can get inflammation of the gums and oral mucosa. And it comes up all the time from dentists. I don't know what this inflammation or gingivitis is. Could it be from mercury exposure? And really, a history is enough to rule it out. You don't need to do any kind of exposure things. Proteinuria is a very nonspecific one, so that doesn't really help a whole lot in terms of diagnosis. But when people come to you and say, I just want to check to see what I have, it's important to understand, first of all, mercury, unlike lead, doesn't keep a very good equilibrium in the system. In other words, your blood levels, depending on what you're looking for, may or may not correlate with what you have. Some serum levels are not so useful. But when you're looking for inorganic mercury, you can do a 24-hour urine testing for children. For adults, you can use mercury creatinine ratio in adults, and the pediatric ones are extrapolated from adult values, so they're not quite quite accurate as they should be. The methyl mercury or ethyl mercury, which is the one that people are mostly concerned about, you need whole blood. And I just got a phone call from lab yesterday. It has to be potassium EDTA tubes for most heavy metals. If you don't have it, you don't preserve the red blood cells well enough to really get an accurate answer. Hair comes up all the time. Can I check hair for different things, anything from radiation exposure to mercury? The answer is maybe. There are values out there for hair level, as we'll see. And usually EPA recommends, and all of us recommend, to use it for population exposure. If there was a massive explosion of somehow mercury vapor in the air or something spilled, and you want to look at the people along the railroad, which has happened in the past, you can, instead of going around and getting everyone's blood or 24-hour urine, which is impractical, get a hair sample and say, was there significant exposure? What are the borders of exposure? So you can, it's better for population studies than anything else. And everything else is more of a screening rather than looking at the actually therapeutic. There has been reports of Pink's disease in a girl in Pakistan for as low as 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood. So different people have different susceptibility. It has to do with how much albumin you have in your blood and bioavailability of these things to various tissues. So you want to be a little bit careful about how you interpret these values and call them that they are or not. I've put in 4 chemicals in there you don't need to remember, but just remember, in children in the U.S., we use Succimer. And you want to be careful about Succimer. People say, I can get Succimer from Mexico. Why don't I just use it? The answer is, first of all, Succimer itself is not a very benign compound. And when you chelate things out of the system, you want to be careful. If the mercury or any kind of metal has been sitting there for quite some time, and it's been sitting in the brain, and now you chelate it out, what people typically see is that you can't really chelate most of the methyl mercury out of the blood, out of the brain anyway. But they see a lot of meningitis with these patients. And it may be that you decrease your serum level, you now have to create a new equilibrium. And as these very polar compounds go along the blood-brain barrier, they cause inflammation. So what they see is a lot of meningeal signs and meningitis-like picture, but Succimer itself could do that. So it's not so clear as to why that is. So you typically chelate when you have to. You don't chelate what you don't have to. And remember, Succimer can also chelate a lot of trace metals that you have, which are valuable, you don't get much of, and you can get very sick from doing that. The last thing I want to put in, BAL, D-penicillamine, are not so practical. They're not used so much in the U.S., but DMPS is the number one choice by WHO. It's not available in the U.S., so people ask for them, and it's just simply not available. Prevention is probably the best thing. We talk about prevention a little bit. The biggest prevention is, you know, don't vacuum any kind of spill. You want to basically pick it up with a dustpan. If you have any sawdust, put it on there and pick it up. That's the better way of doing it. If there's anything remaining, the recommendation is if it's in the carpet, replace the carpet. If not, they recommend hazmat to come in and take care of the place. They do have compounds which will pick up, oxidize it, and then you can remove it. For pregnant women, the recommendations changed a little bit. They used to be 13 ounces per week of lower mercury fish. People talk about salmon, whether it's farmed versus wild is better. The answer is the difference is minuscule. In general, salmon, even though it's an oily fish, it's pretty low in mercury, so it's fine. Albacore tuna, which is canned tuna, is a big source of protein for a lot of families. It's inexpensive, it's well absorbed. And you want to be careful saying don't eat any canned tuna because that may be a big source of protein for them. So if you have 6 ounces per week for lactating mothers or children, that's perfectly fine. The big fish that we usually tell people to avoid, they're not really consumed much in the U.S., and that tends to be swordfish, shark, king mackerel, tilefish, and it has to include whales, but we don't eat much whales in the U.S., so that's not included in there. We talked about whale blubber, and then skin lightening creams, they do get into your system. We don't recommend that. So we typically say avoid these imported skin lightening creams and then industrial exposure. The ones that we use in the U.S. that are pharmaceuticals that are safe for pregnant women. We're going to go to the next case. We come a little bit fast forward to 1891. We're in the south of France. Your Dr. Murray, which you all know who Dr. Murray is, but you may not realize it. You were calling to solve the mystery of a newly famed artist who's rapidly having a declining health. And as you wait in this room with beautiful green wallpaper, which is Prussian green, you notice that this painting, the two paintings done by this artist are very different colors of the same thing. And then there comes in the man who's thin with shiny protuberant cheeks. He's lost quite a bit of hand, and he has atrophied abductor pallidus brevis of both hands with white lines across his nail beds. And right away, you know what this is because you're brilliant. And you've figured out that this, these are St. Victory. Anybody knows who did these paintings? Not quite. No, we'll get there though. So this is basically arsenic poisoning. During this time, arsenic poisoning was not an uncommon thing. A lot of paints, again, have arsenic in them. And people would either poison each other purposely, which has been well documented, and then or just accidentally be exposed. And artists knew how to prevent this up to 200 to 300 years before that. It's interesting that it was kind of a lost art and people didn't realize that this happens with this beautiful new paint called Prussian green. But arsenic, again, comes in elemental, organic, and inorganic. And typically, children can get exposed to all forms of these things. The elemental one, unfortunately, is increasing in our environment just because of the semiconductor industry. It needs to use quite a bit of this. Your computer glass, most companies, some have dropped them, tend to use arsenic to create that clear glass that doesn't have much of a glare. And then there's a natural form of this, which most of the world's population in less industrial countries get exposed to the natural form of this in their water. And the inorganic one, really, we'll talk a little bit more about it. Children do get exposed from time to time. But it's mostly absorbed through ingestion. You don't really absorb this stuff through your skin. When you touch arsenic, it doesn't get absorbed very well. And then it continues to be a big source of water poisoning. And in California, we actually do have this. If you go north of here towards Palmdale, Lancaster, there are a number of families who use well water as their drinking water. You go to Central California, it's a big hip thing that after you do wine drinking, you chase it down with well water, and you want to be a little bit careful. And as you go towards Palm Springs, you know, there are all these signs that the safest water is tap water. What they're really telling you is that don't drink your well water, because your well water has to be monitored continuously for arsenic, especially after earthquakes, which we get quite a bit of. And then And then it's important to realize elemental and inorganic arsenic are much more toxic than its organic form. And as we talked about, coal puts out a lot of arsenic, but because they become organic, they're not as toxic. So at this point, we don't have enough of it in fish to worry about it and regulate it. We're way below that. But if we inch up the way we're inching up, we can get into a concerning level. Sources are, again, we talked about the well water and then anthropogenic. It's used quite a bit. It used to be used quite a bit in agriculture as an herbicide. And it would have wash-offs and runoffs that would go into the rivers, into the fish, and incinerators, which we don't use as much, but in many parts of the world, that's the only way they get rid of their trash or industrial trash, which is even worse. So in the U.S., we do get kids who get exposed to pressure-treated wood, either through playing on them or burning them. And Dr. Jackson's not here, but he could tell us about cases he's seen where kids actually lose hair as if they're getting chemo because every winter they burn railroad wood. And so that's one of the ways that you can do it. And FDA has now banned residential wood treatments since 2003, but there are quite a few jungle gyms left out there that still have this. Pesticide, this has been banned, but you still see large batches of arsenic. I'm not sure where they come from. The most recent case was because arsenic has no taste, color, and looks just like water, they made baby formula using it. And remember, when you put arsenic into baby formula, it turns pink. So if your formula is turning pink, be suspicious. And the two kids died within a few hours. One of them died within a day or so. It was published recently. So those are some of the things to be careful about. And they somehow had the arsenic sitting around in a water bottle in their garage. Rice, we'll talk a little bit about it. You get a lot of questions on rice and fish as to whether it's really relevant or not. In Western diet, you may or may not get enough. It's rare, but people do get enough rice that it could be of levels that FDA is concerned about. When you get acute, which is really one of the hardest things to deal with, it causes vomiting within 30 minutes. And remember, arsenic, the way it kills, is that an anti-metabolite. It shuts down your mitochondrial metabolic function. So not only it's by itself corrosive and a little bit toxic, but also it shuts down, but it shuts it down very quickly. And in the process, what happens is that the tissue starts sloughing off, and it goes from top to bottom. It sloughs off through the stomach, and it goes all the way to the intestines. So they start having vomiting, diarrhea, which is normal at the beginning. It becomes bloody very quickly. And then 3% have a bloody or rice diarrhea at the beginning, and then eventually they end up having Mies lines if they do survive, and we'll see what the means lies die. Most die from shock and hypovolemia. So it's a good idea to support them. And if you support them as they clear arsenic through their system, they may survive. The problem is with high exposure, there hasn't been much success in salvaging most of these children. So these are Mies lines. And you always get a little bit of white dye going across your nails. So don't look at it. It's too dark here anyway. But when you don't put pressure on your nail beds, you see this white line going across, is subungual, a line that goes through. And this is one of the findings that you see. In a more protracted, so lower dose acute form, you get facial edema, transient flushing, and it's very difficult to diagnose based on clinical findings. You typically need a history of arsenic poison, and most of these cases have been like husband and wife who tried to poison each other, and they thought they can get away with it. So be careful. People are much more aware of it. But clinically, as you can tell, it looks like, oh, you're just getting old. So don't complain and take your arsenic. But they do go to congestive heart failure and shock, and that's, again, a lot of metalloids do this. They cause cardiomyopathy. And then sensory motor peripheral axonal neuropathy. And they, again, go to the kidneys eventually. They deposit in the kidneys that cause proteinuria, hematuria, and eventually cause bone marrow suppression, which could come early on. It's very interesting that it could come very late or it could come very early on. And conjunctivitis. Again, a lot of these things are nonspecific, so it's a little bit hard to diagnose this based on clinical finding. And that's probably true for most environmental stuff. That's why we always say history, 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 which is really hard to do, and you got to get a lot of history from these parents if you ever suspect it. But it's hard to diagnose these things based on clinical findings. Every time somebody comes up with T-wave inversion, you can't really do arsenic workup. Chronic exposure in children, it tends to be, again, starts with bone marrow depression, generalized fatigue, and then they get skin changes. And skin changes are probably one of the most pronounced things that you find in these patients. We're going to see some of these things. Liver dysfunction and neurologic dysfunction come on. Risk factor in children is not so clear, but in adult, there is a lot of adult onset, so arsenic takes a long while for it to really kick in. And we do know it does cause cancer. The cancers tend to be skin, lung, bladder, and liver, and it loves to go to the liver also. It causes a lot of liver and bladder cancers. This is a typical thing that you talk about. So I wanted to put in these things not only because it helps to see what it looks like, but when people talk about hyperkeratosis, it's quite pronounced. It's not like you get a little bit of thickening here and there or a little bit of liver spot here and there. That means you have arsenic exposure, but it does cause premature liver spots on the back of the hand, which you have to be careful. It could be just normal lipofuscinosis, or it could be related to exposures, arsenic being simply one of those. But hypermelanosis of the chest, and you get it going up the neck. So they get a lot of hypermelanosis going up the neck, and eventually comes to the face also. And again, it's typically not this severe or pronounced. But if you look at this, this patient has both hyperkeratosis and hypermelanosis, which is a little bit hard to see on the sides. You see these things. And people attribute them to a lot of sun exposure, things of that sort, but again, it could be arsenic exposure doing this. Chronic exposure in children usually causes spontaneous abortion. You do see this in places like Bangladesh, where there's a lot of exposure to arsenic, natural arsenic. Stillbirth, low birth weight, and preterm delivery, depending on how low exposure you have. So you need to have a very low exposure in order to have a viable pregnancy that's preterm. So arsenic is mostly excreted through the kidneys. When you do a urine test, which is really the best test for this thing, you want to be able to differentiate the toxic, not organic, which is inorganic or elemental arsenic, from the organic type. And fractionation is not something that's available in most institutions. So one of the things you can do, the poor man's way, is to have them stop having any kind of fish or seafood 2 to 5 days prior, and then do a 24-hour urine test. You can do an arsenic creatinine ratio, and again, it's very inaccurate as a screening. But if it's extremely low, you don't have to worry about it. But if you see it being elevated within 24 hours, then you have something there. One thing to remember is that if you've been exposed to arsenic and now your urine is negative and it's been 3 months since fasting, unfortunately, the clinical effect of these things will keep going. They keep doing destructive work, which could cause long-term effects like cancer, but you will not be able to pick them up very well. So it's a good idea if they have chronic exposure to check them right there and then. And if they have stopped using any kind of arsenic or been exposed to arsenic, then that's a different story. You may or may not be able to pick it up if it's not being excreted actively and it's deposited in the tissue. Treatments. You have to have significant exposure to get chelation, but usually you want to do it with a toxicologist, and you'll see why, because none of these chemicals are well studied. We don't have a lot of experience with our arsenic exposure in the Western Hemisphere. And those who get exposed quite a bit, they don't have access to treatment. So unfortunately, there's no good science behind any of these things. But in the order of preference, D-penicillamine tends to be the one that's much more practical. You can do it for about 5 days. And you want to make sure you follow these patients, make sure they're not having any other signs or symptoms of anything else. And succimer, that people think is a universal thing you can just throw at patients, is your third choice. It's not very useful. When arsenic makes it into the brain, you can't really get it out very well. So the best thing to do is to prevent. In fact, none of these recommendations in terms of treatment are universally accepted. Most people talk about just supportive care and prevention. And drinking water, all well water has to be tested, especially after an earthquake. And people do come, if you ever work in Lancaster area, people will come and tell you that public health came around and checked their water from time to time. The problem with this is if your well water wasn't affected after an earthquake and a well water 100 miles upstream was affected, in about 3 months you may get that, even without an earthquake. These things do connect underground through aqueducts, which is something I used to do in my previous life. And so you're going to be a little bit careful. And again, these are low amounts, so they don't show up right away. And then you want to avoid arsenic contaminated water or soil in agriculture, especially in rice. So let me talk a little bit about rice. People talk about rice cereal being a big social problem. Rice cereal, the amount that babies take, is just not enough to cause arsenic poisoning. The source of rice, there are very few countries that have rice that has high enough arsenic, that if you eat as much as those cultures eat, then you can get significant exposure. And even then, in those populations, when we look at it, it's hard to tell, where did all the arsenic come from? Was it from their drinking water, from their cooking and all the other things, or was it purely from rice? Then people talk about, well, don't eat brown rice. We used to say, oh, eat brown rice. Now they're going back to eat white rice. That's nonsense. The problem is, it really has to do with the species of rice. What season it was picked up, where was it picked up? There's so many factors that you can't tell. What we do know is that you need to get a significant amount of rice to get this. But yes, if you're eating three meals of rice, big meals of rice every day, then you can get some arsenic into your system that's detectable and goes above what's recommended. But that's rare. And avoiding and changing cultural diets is really not recommended based on that alone, because we don't know if it has any significant clinical effect in those patients. There are papers, and there's one or two papers on if you take garlic with them or any kind of sulfates with these things, they mitigate the effect. They're very poorly done studies. They're observational studies. There's no evidence that they're of any useful. So Don't go on a garlic binge if you eat rice, thinking that you're going to make a difference or not. But we do know, never burn or saw treated wood. They should actually be dumped very properly. Avoid old wooden cribs. And then if there are jungle gyms, nobody agrees on how often you need to seal these things. We actually had this national debate on this when I was writing a chapter on this as to how often should you do this. Some manufacturers of sealants say, oh, every 5 years is good enough. Some say every 10 years. But I think the sense is every 6 months to annually is probably adequate to do this, because a little bit of leakage can get into the kid system. But if the kids are exposed to these things, you want to wash your hands. And one of the ways you can kind of tell, these woods have a mossy green look to them. There are copper arsenate. So as they get oxidized, they get kind of greenish. It's a beautiful green. And if kids are exposed to these, it's either avoid it or you just wash your hands. And a lot of places, they're replacing these things. Moving on to our very last case. In 1920, you've been called to the bedside of really one of the most accomplished scientists who's ever lived. And the hint is this is the only scientist who's ever won two Nobel Prizes in two different fields of science. There's only one. Her symptoms include progressive fatigue, pallor, and poor immunity. She eventually succumbed to a rare form of anemia. So I wanted to talk a little bit about radiation because, you know, those of you who work with me, you know, I'm very wary of doing chest x-rays or any kind of x-rays in children unless we absolutely have to. But to understand why, and to understand why when people say this x-ray is equivalent to walking around or being on a plane for about a plane ride, is completely irrelevant. They may make patients more comfortable, but it's not so relevant as this. The amount of energy you deliver to tissue of the body is not all the same. So there are these two units. One is gray. It purely looks at how much energy per kilogram you deliver to the body. The other one is called sievert. Sievert is not energy per kilogram, but also an equivalent biological effect. And to understand what this means, there's this thing, which I'm sure you can all read and memorize very well. But the biological effects of 1 gray of X-ray radiation is to 1 gram of liver is equivalent to 4 grays of radiation, X-ray radiation, to 1 gram of brain. In other words, brain is 4 times more resilient to radiation. than liver is. At the same time, you can expose a patient to 1 gray of X-ray radiation to 1 gram of liver, and it has the 1/20th of the destructive effect as if you expose them to nuclear fission products at the same amount to the same exact tissue. So that's because the alpha particles, as they go through, it's not just the energy radiation, they actually destroy, as if like bullets going through your cell, and they destroy your DNA. So 1 gray of that is 20 times more destructive than 1 gray of X-ray. So what clinical effect does any of this have? So people have done some very clever studies. They looked at if you had tuberculosis, and you were checked for your tuberculosis or your scoliosis, does it really make any kind of an effect? And there are two different units used for assessing the risk factor for increasing your risk of cancer. And one is called estimated risk, that increased risk, and it becomes 3.6. Remember, at one, that means 100% more chance of having it. Remember, you're multiplying a very small number by 2, essentially. So you have 3.6. Your risk of cancer, by the time you're done checking somebody for tuberculosis, which is about 2.1 grays of exposure to the chest, it goes up a little bit. And this is for children. And the mean age was about 26. So the typical age was 26. There were some older, there were some younger. But there are no good studies in very young children. We do know the younger you get, the more susceptible you are. Scoliosis, which usually starts, and it's mostly in girls, the studies looked at girls who were around 11 years of age, and for 0.1 gray of exposure, the risk went up significantly. So it really depends on where you're exposing and what you're exposing them for and what kind of X-ray you're doing. Leukemia, X-ray of broken bones, your leukemia risk goes up by 0.04. Your odds ratio goes up by 0.04. So it's not a huge number, but it happens to be one. And the number of X-rays we're studying in this, it was just one. Okay? One X-ray to the bone increases your odds ratio in general by 0.04. And then what's interesting is that you can actually decrease your odds ratio or your chance of cancer by exposure. And cardiologists may gloat about this, but when you do cardiac cath, which happens to be at very young age, at a pretty good gray of 0.2 to 0.5, for every procedure, your odds ratio actually goes down. But as you increase it, we don't know what happens to your odds ratio. For whatever reason, probably because it's very focused on the heart, and heart doesn't really multiply, and you don't have any flat bones sitting between you and the heart as much, your odds ratio actually goes down a little bit. And so there's a lot to understand about these things. But signs and symptoms of radiation, there's a radiation disaster. Everybody's concerned about Southern California. It does get a little bit of exposure, not significant. But signs and symptoms of radiation sickness usually appear when the entire body is exposed to 1 gray. And once you get to 6 grays, there's almost no chance of survival. Typically, they present with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea and headache. And they usually have neurologic, and then bone marrow starts failing, and then they get poor wound healing and low blood pressure. And that's one of the ways you can actually diagnose these things. You only do this if you've had, let's say, a dirty bomb or you've been nearby a leaking nuclear plant. This is what you would do. There are DNA markers that you can check for very quickly. But for general populations, probably looking at the white count, if everybody's dropping, then it's got significant exposure. And then you can look at it. The three other methods are not as easy to look at simply because you have to be there to look at this. One is the dosimeter that really has to be done at the time when you're radiated. A lot of radiologists have this thing. Astronauts get these things. There are a number of ways that you can do this. And then Geiger counter, which you've all seen in movies, and it's really fun to play with, I'll tell you. And basically, you can survey the field. So if you're going to Chernobyl, you want to study the soil, and you want to see how much of the fission product that you're getting, then you can do those things. Measurement of isotopes is what's happening right now in Japan. They look at cesium and iodine, and iodine has a very short half-life, so again, that's not a best thing, and cesium is another one that you check for, especially if you've worked in a nuclear plant or you've been exposed to leak You can look at cesium for these patients. How do you treat these things? I should have put external decontamination as number one. That's the first thing you do. And I was in Santa Monica Hospital and noticed that's what they're practicing. When they wash it with all that water and the water runoff becomes a problem, in fact. But that's really the best thing to do. And then you do supportive care for those with low white count. Prussian blue itself is extremely toxic. But if you have a choice between dying from radiation or dealing with Prussian blue contamination, you deal with that. But it's only good for two of these elements, cesium and thallium, which you can get thallium, and some nuclear reactors do have thallium exposure. And DTPA, again, binds to the particles, but not every particle, plutonium, americium, and curium, and it comes through the urine. And really, the hallmark becomes supportive care, supportive care, supportive care. And we do know from the Japanese experience that supportive care can go a long way. So let me give you a little bit of the fun part of this presentation. Madame Marie Curie, which I can't say her middle name, she was actually Polish-French. She's the only one who's ever won two Nobel Prizes for two different fields in science. So a number of people have won two, but not in two different fields of science. And if ever going gets really tough, read about how she had to go from where she was to where she became, even applying for grants and things that are short, and you realize, oh, things are much better now. even with the cuts and everything. She came up with radium polonium. She won the Nobel Prize in both physics and chemistry. And it's interesting. I was always taught that she died because in the process of her research, she dealt with so much radioactive material that she died. She died not because of that. She died because she ran a World War I X-ray clinic, one of the very first ones, and I think it might have been the first one, for the French troops. And in the process of doing so many x-rays and running this clinic, she got exposed, and that's what's believed to have caused her death. So we take x-ray exposures very seriously. Her notes and everything else is contaminated with polonium, and polonium is extremely toxic. And it's a radioactive material of choice for killing, assassinating people, and Russians love this stuff. But it's well published that, you know, we know that's what they use. So that's what she did. In 1906, when she became the first woman to ever teach physics in academic center, this next person unfortunately passed away. He was on his last year of life. And this is Paul Cézanne. I try to actually make sure these cases relate to each other. So that's the closest thing I could come to. In 1906, Paul Cézanne died. And Paul Cézanne, this is from the time when he looked good. And unfortunately, he became very gaunt. He lost a lot of weight. He got diabetes. And one of the things arsenic can do is that it can cause type 1-like diabetes at older age. And the two paintings that I showed, one, the green one was done early on in life where he had good vision. And then later on when he lost his vision, he just couldn't decipher colors very well. And he died basically frustrated by the fact that he couldn't paint St. Victor, quite capture what nature, as he said, told him to do this. Dr. Murray is the doctor who you saw last week in The Doctor by Sir Luke, and he was a physician who cared for the son of Sir Luke Fields. And he depicted him in this painting. What's interesting is that eventually he decided, you know what, I want to put my own face in there. So this is actually Sir Luke Fields, but it was painted after Dr. Murray. And I guess he always wanted to be a doctor. He said, this is my last chance to put myself as a doctor. This painting should be part of the curriculum for all medical students. There's so much in this painting. It's fascinating. It tells you so much about what happened at that time. And people have analyzed and done thesis on this. The picture you see on the left side is very important. Women of this era, especially rich women of this era, had a tremendous amount of much more than what's believed of hysteria, which that's what they called it. But in fact, it certainly goes way back. But if you look at this, women who could afford Prussian green paint would have it everywhere. And this is a prime example of this. This is not a picture by Cézanne. This is another painting. But it tells you about the history of the time. The wallpaper, her clothing, even the stationery, everything's green. She lives in a well-lit room, which only the rich could afford. When the humidity comes in, fungus grows in the wallpaper. The humidity and the fungus will actually chelate the wall, and arsenic gets into the room. So during winter time, when they had sunlight, but the windows were closed And that humidity, they would get arsenic exposure. And by the end of that, a lot of times during springtime, they had a lot of depression, anxiety, and they just attributed to other causes until a very clever chemist figured out, oh, this stuff is not good. So they phased them out. You can still buy Prussian blue if you're a painter. And what's interesting is that the science was lost. 300 years before that, they all knew this, which brings us to the next case. If I ever time travel, I want to spend 10 minutes and no more than that with this guy. This is one of the richest and one of the smartest painters who's ever lived. And what he did, we believe he poisoned his customers. He hated the rich and the powerful, which is exactly what his family was. And he would donate these beautiful paintings that were painted in a way that we knew artists at the time knew not to do. And they would do, he would do this, and him and his wife would basically cause death in their customers. And a lot of their customers would either get gravely ill or die. And if you ever know anything about painting, you know, you don't paint this way unless you really want to do damage. What's interesting about him is that because he was a German painter, he was a very concise painter. And if you look at his self-portrait, he has anisocoria. His pupils are unequal. And anisocoria happens in about 7 or 8 diseases. They're all rare, but except for 2 allow you to live a natural lifespan. One is called Reeder syndrome, which is a variant of migraine. And only type 1 and 2 allows you to live a long time, which is what he could have had. And the other one is arsenic poisoning. Because he doesn't have much of a ptosis on either side, he most likely didn't have migraine, and he had arsenic poisoning himself. So this is another fascinating thing. And if you look at paintings, it's amazing how much you can pick out about the history of medicine and what people got exposed, what people went through, what diseases they had. And he's one of the hallmarks of this, and people, again, do a lot of PhDs on what he did. He also put in a lot of codes that meant different things in his painting, so it's a subject of much fascination. Very clever man, very interesting history. 9 o'clock, I'm going to stop right there. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.